Let us continue with the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, the two kinds of thought, and see what happens next in this sutta. So, we've just been looking at what happens, how the Buddha deals, the Buddha-to-be, how he deals with sensual thoughts when it arises. And as I was just looking at it, we were saying, all he does, he just reflects that this is a problem, this is an affliction to oneself, right? To my own affliction. And just by thinking that, just by understanding fully the extent to which sensuality is a problem, then straight away the thought is abandoned. And the point here is that this is a very powerful way of dealing with this, because it doesn't just suppress the thought, but it abandons the thought entirely, and it stays gone for a long time as a consequence. And then having thought about it in this way, the alternative way is to think that it also leads to other people's affliction, right? When we, again, similar kind of idea, if it is a problem for others, and then also you abandon these things straight away. And of course, this is one of these things, is that when you have sensuality, you have attachments and all of these kind of things, and that always leads to a sense of vested interest, a sense of problem in our relationship to others as well. We tend to exploit people more, to use people to our advantage, and all of this kind that is in the nature of sensuality, at least to some extent. And then we have the idea that it leads to both people's problems, right? Usually when you have sensuality, it's not one or the other. It's not just my problem or somebody else's problem. Usually it goes both ways. And that is the other one there. But essentially all of these three things refer to the same things I was talking about before. And we're going to have a look at this in more detail later on. There is suffering always involved with sensuality, one way or another. And this is part of the problem here. So then we come to the last three things that he reflects on. And he reflects on the idea that this obstructs wisdom. Pali word panya nirodhika, which literally means that it leads to the ending or the cessation of wisdom, right? A very interesting idea, of course, because on the Buddhist path, on the spiritual practice, what we are really trying to achieve is precisely wisdom. This is like the highest faculty, the faculty which keeps all the other faculties aloft, which enables the stability of everything else in our practice. So if it leads to the ending or cessation of wisdom, obviously it is a very serious problem that we are dealing with. For me, at least, when I think about wisdom, I always feel wisdom is one of those things that are very powerful, powerful sources for good in this world. If there's anything I would like to have, it's more wisdom. Everything else is kind of secondary, but more wisdom always sounds very nice. So anything that makes wisdom cease is always a bad thing. And I think you can feel that very quickly, that when you are, these defilements arise in the mind, you can actually feel that there is a lack of clarity there. There is a sense that you are being drawn by things, you're no longer neutral, you're no longer seeing things according to the true nature. And then when desire arises, you can see how you kind of are biased in your outlook. And then when you sit back and you feel at ease, the mind is clear, there's no strong hindrances in the mind, it's almost as if you know almost through direct experience, this is the kind of mind that sees clearly. So just sometimes all you have to do is to feel the difference between these things. And as you feel that difference, you will actually see for yourself, I think, quite clearly that there is a problem with these kind of defilements. And then you have to remember, once the defilement arises, often it is too late, it's hard to see. You have to remember that time when your mind had a sense of clarity, and then reflect back to that time, and then know the difference, the consequent difference there. So that's really bad news, right? It obstructs wisdom. That is a really bad one. Causes difficulties, similar to the previous ones. Vigata is a word for difficulties here. So causes kind of vigata. Yeah, I guess difficulties is good enough. And leads away from Nibbana is the last one there. And again, remember, it's important to remember when you see things like leading away from Nibbana. What does it actually mean? Because if we don't know what Nibbana means, then it's hard to really have a feeling for this, right? So the idea of Nibbana, the word in English means like to extinguish something. So it means, in a sense, extinguishment. And the things that we are extinguishing in Buddhism is the fires of the defilements, the desires, the anger, all of these things that lead to all of these problems that we're just looking at. That is actually what we are extinguishing. So it leads away from that mind which is kind of unruffled and peaceful, not being jagged, pulled away this way and that way, by these defilements, the desires and the ill will and these kind of things. So it leads to that peace of Nibbana, the extinguishment of all of these problems. In the suttas, the defilements are always called the fire of desire, right? This burns you, the burning of desire, the burning of ill will. And when you feel these things, it is in a sense like you are being burned. You feel agitated by these things. So leading away from this. It's very useful sometimes to reflect on terms like Nibbana in this ordinary senses, because that is really often what they refer to. So when you become peaceful in meditation, right, you sit down, you feel relaxed, you feel at peace, that is already like a little bit of Nibbana. You have some idea of what Nibbana means. And the Buddha often talks about Nibbana, like different levels of Nibbana. Nibbana to this extent, Nibbana to that extent, preliminary Nibbana and final Nibbana. Right? So when you have a little bit of Nibbana, right, it's good news already. So feel that kind of the positive experience of things kind of fading away, being less burning, being more cool as a consequence of your meditation practice, then you have some idea what Nibbana actually refers to. So it's good, it's nice, but you only have a tiny bit of experience and compared to what eventually it leads to. So you can see you're heading in the wrong direction if these defilements are there. So these are all bad news, right? So you have to reflect on all of these things and you have to become clear how negative this is. And once you understand these things, that this obstructs wisdom, one of those things really worth having in this world, the one thing perhaps more worth having than anything else in this world, that becomes obstructed, that ceases, that ends when sensual desire arises. So it really is bad. And of course, when you reflect in all of these ways, just as I was saying before, then and what happens? Then you abandon that thought. You remove it. You do away with it. And these words are very strong words. Removing something, doing away with it. Other places, these things are translated as obliterating and annihilating these things. Very powerful words. And again, if you read that as it stands, it feels a bit like it means it needs some kind of force to be able to do that. If you're going to obliterate something, it sounds you're using a lot of force to get rid of it. But this is actually the point, right? Is that you don't obliterate things. You don't remove them. You don't annihilate them. You don't do away with them by force. Because force, again, suppresses it a little bit, keeps it down, and as soon as the force is gone, it comes back again. It wasn't really obliterated properly. The way that you obliterate it, rather, is precisely through wisdom. Because when you see that something really is a problem, then the mind turns away from that. And when it turns away from it, it takes a while before it kind of can turn back into that direction again. And then it is really annihilated, really is obliterated, at least for a certain period of time. Then you are free of that one, right? It's gone. The whole sensual thought has disappeared. And this is kind of the what this is about. So far more powerful to use this kind of wisdom than it is to use willpower in these cases. Of course, it is not the case that willpower is entirely wrong in all situations. Sometimes these defilements can be very powerful, they can overwhelm you, and sometimes you may not have much choice to use a little bit of willpower to get away from these things. But the ideal way, and the way that is most powerful, is, it says here, precisely, wisdom power. Willpower is a secondary thing you use if the wisdom power doesn't work. If you haven't developed it properly, then sometimes we may use a bit of willpower. But this is the ideal way of doing things, and this is what really makes these things go away in a powerful way. So that is the sensual desire. Then we have exactly the same paragraph with thoughts of ill will, and the thoughts of being ruthless and harmful are the next ones. So as I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and with effort, a thought with ill will arose in me, a thought with harming arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of harming, or this thought which is imbued with harming, if you like, has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, leads away from Nibbana. When I considered thus, these things subsided in me. When the thought of harming arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So here we have ill will. First of all, exactly the same thing. And of course, with ill will, generally speaking, it's much easier to understand why it leads to our affliction, why it leads to our suffering. This is so much more obvious. When we have ill will, it causes problems with the people around us, it causes problems in our relationships. Nobody really likes somebody who is always angry. You know how terrible it is to be around people who are angry a lot. You kind of want to get away from them because it's just too kind of painful to be there. So ill will has very, very bad consequences. And very often when you are when ill will arises in you, you know, it's quite easy to see how blinded you are at that time. And of course, because you are blinded by the ill will, you end up doing silly things, saying things, even acting out things, and then later on you regret that. And that is the kind of the hallmark of being blinded, is that it seems right at the time, and later on you understand that it was wrong. You can see the delusion there. Right? And this is kind of the point here. You can quite clearly see what is going on. And if you look around the world and all the things that are happening in society everywhere, a lot of that is driven by these kind of defilements, driven by ill will, driven by even by sensual desire, wanting to control the resources, wanting to control the world around us. Right, often this is driven by desire and perhaps some extent of ill will as well. So it is a problem on the personal level, it's a problem on the family level, problem in the it's community level, problem on the large international level, problems everywhere. These defilements kind of cause so much havoc in our society. If we didn't have these kind of things, there wouldn't be many problems in the world at all. And the last one is the here again, the cruelty, the vihinsa vitaka, right? Thoughts imbued with a degree of callousness, coldness, lack of caring for other people. It's interesting that this lack of care, the lack of, you know, being ruthless or whatever, is itself a bad kind of thought, or not at least a thought which has that quality to it, if you like. So if you have the quality of being harsh or ruthless or whatever, it's the exact opposite of compassion. Compassion means that you care for other beings, you have a sense of when they suffer and you don't want them to suffer unnecessarily. To be ruthless is the opposite of that. You are the kind of tough business person, right, who goes out, okay, business is more important than everything else. If it has negative effects on others, well, I don't really care. Business is what matters. I got to go out there and do these things. So this is a kind of ruthlessness. And that in itself is here said to be bad kind of thought. It, we've seen before, leads to bad actions, leads to problems. even if it is kind of inadvertent, the fact that you hurt others, still it is bad according to this, which is actually quite interesting. So a degree of compassion, understanding is really required. So in all of these cases, the same kind of thinking, right? Understanding the problems involved with this is what is really important here. And then comes a couple of other paragraphs that are interesting. And I'm going to swap these paragraphs around. There is one paragraph that has a nice simile. As always, there are so many nice similes in the suttas. And this simile is as follows. Just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if he let those cows stray into the crops. So too I saw in the unwholesome states danger, degradation, defilement, and in wholesome qualities the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. So here you have this idea that mind is compared to a cow, right? So you treat your mind a bit like you treat the cows. You tap the mind on one side, you tap the mind on the other side, so it doesn't go too far to the left or too far to the right, but it kind of stays down the middle road of the Noble Eightfold Path, goes in the right way here. So this is kind of the idea here. You exert a little bit of control, in a sense, on your own mind to make sure it goes in the right way. Because if your mind strays into the crops, right, the crops probably like the sensual pleasures or the obviously the ill will as well, but certainly the sensual pleasures here, if it strays into there, then you will be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed. In other words, it leads to suffering. This is what he's talking about all the time here. It leads to problems. And because you understand this, you keep on tapping that mind in the right direction. You act like that little cowherd inside. You have that sense of, you guard them. Again, the idea here is the idea of mindfulness, right? Mindfulness being there, watching what is going on, seeing the danger with sampajanya, with clear awareness and clear comprehension, so actually the mind heads down the right track. You can see how all of these things are always interrelated with each other, all these concepts all the way through. And because I saw in the unwholesome qualities, the danger, the ardinava, the degradation, or kara means to make something low, right? It's like you're bringing yourself down, making yourself feel low if you have too many of these defilements in the mind. You feel like slightly degraded. And you can probably relate to that as well. Sometimes when the mind is pure, you feel kind of good about yourself. But if there's too much of this stuff in the mind, you feel slightly degraded as a consequence. You don't feel like you have the same stature almost as of a human being. You feel kind of like it's almost like a lower kind of existence in a sense. And of course, the defilement of these things that defile the mind. They kind of dirty. You feel dirty, in a sense, when these things happen. And the wholesome qualities, the blessing of giving these things up, renouncing these things, you see, understand the blessing of that, and the aspect of cleaning up the mind. This is the, what is the Pali here? I can't remember, but it's the idea of cleaning things up. Suddhi, probably, parisuddhi or something like that. So make sure that you look after your mind, that you think that you kind of look after your own little cow a little bit. We can all be cowherds to some extent. Okay, and then we have this going back one paragraph again. It's interesting, the reason why I'm swapping these two around is because in the Chinese version, in the Agamas, these paragraphs are swapped around. So you can see how closely these suttas are related to each other. You can tell straight away that the paragraphs are swapped. The differences are very minor between the Chinese translation and the Pali. So, bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then his mind inclines to thought of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will, upon thoughts of cruelty or harmfulness, his mind has abandoned the thought of non-cruelty to cultivate harmfulness, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of harmfulness. So this is, again, an important passage because it shows us that we tend to follow according to habits. And I think you all know that, and very often when, you know, a certain person kind of says a certain thing, then you tend to react in a certain way. We always, because that is kind of irritating or difficult or is desirable or whatever it is, we tend to follow these patterns and habit patterns in our mind. And that is often why it is so hard to change, right? Because the same thing happens every time. And when it happens, you react in exactly the same way here. You are like being manipulated, like a doll being manipulated. And people just press your buttons, and when they press button A, you say B, and when they press button B, you say C or whatever. And you feel almost like you're like a robot being manipulated by other people and by these things. And it is a bit like that. This is a bit like what the world is like. And this is why people can manipulate us, right? Because they know the right buttons to press and these kind of things. And it's not very nice. It's not very good. We'd like to get out of those things. And this is one of the hardest things on the Buddhist path, is to change these habits, because they are often very strongly and deeply ingrained, often going back many lifetimes into the past. Especially things like sensual desire is probably something we have been doing, you know, for almost forever, going backwards. Probably no beginning to this. And of course, ill will as well. So because of that, we're like this super tanker going down the ocean, full speed, right? And a super tanker weighs millions, or how much does it weigh? Lots and lots of tons anyway. And very, very difficult to turn that super tanker around. It has to go for kilometers and kilometers before you can turn it around. So we are a bit like this super tanker or a freight train hurtling down the tracks at 100 miles an hour, very weighty and very heavy. So we have to be very patient with ourselves. Make sure that we contemplate wisely over a long period of time, that we do it again and again and again. And as we do that, we are slowly changing the course of the mind, right? Slowly moving in a different direction. And as we keep on doing that and doing that and doing that, we're moving around more and more and more, until one day we're facing in exactly the opposite direction. And that is when you feel that your mind has actually, now the habit is the other thing. Now the habit is to be kind rather than having ill will. And suddenly that is the natural way the mind tends to go, towards kindness and gentleness and compassion, all of these kind of things. So habits is so important here, and very useful. If you get into that habit, of course, then the path is so easy here. So the idea with the Buddhist path is that often it is harder to begin with, because the mind is often heading in the wrong direction, has all these bad habits. As we change the habits and we're heading in the right direction, suddenly it becomes very easy, for exactly the same reason as it was difficult before, because now the habits have been sorted out and you're going in the right direction with these things. Sounds good, doesn't it? So we just have to keep on practicing, keep on doing it, and then these things happen as a matter of course, after a while. You keep on frequently thinking and pondering these things. And again, as I was saying so many times before, especially at the beginning of this retreat, to be able to frequently frequently thinking and pondering in these things, you have to have that input all the time that reminds you of these things. Because the reason why we don't frequently think and ponder upon these things is that we forget it. Especially in daily life when there are so many things going on. So easy to be sidetracked. So easy to go down the wrong way. So you have to keep on reminding yourself, conditioning the mind. And as you do that, you actually do start to think differently. You start to look at people around you in a new way. Your perceptions change, and gradually the super tanker is heading in a different direction. And that's really nice when that happens. So this is about making these things into a habit. And this is so that is what that little passage is about. That aspect of the sutta. Now we're going to have a look at the reverse side. We have seen the negative side. We will see also have a look at the positive side. As I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and with effort, a thought of renunciation arose in me, or a thought affected, if you like, by renunciation arose in me. I understood thus. This thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction or to the suffering of others or to the suffering of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and it leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, my mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from samadhi. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, and brought it to singleness and stilled it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. So here we have the exact opposite thought. These are now the wholesome thoughts. So you're abiding in the right way, and then this thought of renunciation arises in me. And the thought of renunciation is really just a thought of giving things up, especially in the sensual world. When you start to see the danger in these things, your mind turns away from that. And that is really what is meant by a thought of renunciation here. You want to give it up, at least a little bit initially, because you see some degree of danger there. And I think everyone who is on the Buddhist path, we're all doing a little bit of renunciation already. Because just by keeping the five precepts, already you're doing a bit of renunciation. Whenever you go on the retreat, you keep 8 precepts. You know, when you keep the 8 precepts, you're getting very close to being a monastic, right? So you come down to Jhana Grove, or maybe you have a retreat here in Malaysia, or wherever it is. When you do that, you're living really like a monastic for a few days. You get the taste of monasticism when you go on a retreat. 8 precepts, you're getting very, very close to what the monastic life is like. That's quite nice, isn't it? Get a taste of that. And then you are really getting into the renunciation part of things. And of course, when they have a thought of renunciation, then first of all, you are aware of that. You know what it means to renounce things. And then you know that this is precisely the kind of thing that does not lead to suffering for myself, for others, or for both. When you give things up in the world, then there is no conflict anymore. There's no vested interest. There is no abuse of anyone. There's no need for you to kind of exert your power over others because you want stuff, because you're letting all of those things be. The less we desire, the less we want, the less conflict there is in the world, the less problem there is with other people. This is part of the problem with sensual desires, this kind of the conflict that arises as a consequence. And for that reason, you can be at peace with it, other people will be at peace, and both will be at peace. It aids wisdom because, again, your mind is pure. It is not distorted or biased or even perverted by the fact that of sensual desire. It biases the mind, right? It gives rise to desiring things which are not really helpful at all. causes difficulties in the mind and leads away from Nibbana, because again, there's no clarity there. There's no peace with these things. Now the peace is there. But then, of course, the interesting thing here is that it says here, if I think and ponder upon this, even for a night or a day or a night and day, there is nothing to fear from this, because obviously these are positive thoughts. But there is still a drawback, and the drawback is that it tires the body and the mind when you do this. And when you tire the body and the mind is far from stillness. And this is one of these important things. So what you can see here is the gradual movement of the mind, the gradual giving up of things. And it's important to remember that things have to be given up gradually, and that we don't actually do things too fast, or we get things in the wrong order. If you get things in the wrong order, chances are you will not have success as a consequence. So when we talk about practicing this path, we always should start with those things that are the biggest problems, right? And that is why we often start off with ethical conduct of body and speech. These are kind of the main issues. And then you move on to the mind, the main problems in the mind, like serious immorality of anger and strong greed and these kind of things. And then you deal with the small issues in the mind, the kind of the remnant of the hindrances that are there. And then when all of that is abandoned, that is when you abandon thinking altogether. Even the wholesome thinking is abandoned after that. But it's important to get this in the right order. And very often we try, even though our minds are not very pure yet, we try to sit down and still the mind completely. It's going to be impossible. It is impossible, because the defilements are just behind the curtain, just waiting to pop out at any time and kind of scare you, right? And they're kind of there. And the mind cannot really become properly settled and calm as long as those defilements are too close. So we need to abandon as much of that as possible. And then only can we actually give up the thinking altogether and enter a deep state of samadhi. One stage at a time, one thing at a time, knowing the sequence here is actually quite important. So this is what is happening here. This is why we're talking about giving up the problems and then giving up thinking altogether at the very bottom here. So thinking tires the body, right? So it's so I guess you even get physically tired in a sense by thinking too much. And this is what we were talking about before, when you use too much willpower, because that's what thinking really is about. It's a certain amount of willpower involved, because it is intention and willpower that drives the thinking. So because of that, you tire yourself physically. And when you get tired physically, it also affects the mind as well. The mind is obviously very closely related to all of this. And when the mind is tired, then it has no energy, it has no ability to actually be stilled and reach samadhi. Remember again, if you look back upon the seven factors of awakening, right? The seven factors of awakening say that energy arises after mindfulness. You have the mindfulness, investigational dhamma, then the energy, piti, the rapture, then the tranquility, and then, of course, samadhi comes from that. So all of these cases, it's important to get things in the right way, in the right sequence. The mind which is tired doesn't have any energy. When you have no energy, samadhi is impossible. One of the nice ways of checking out if your mind is on the right track is how energized it is. Is it energetic? Does it have these factors coming together of joy, coming together with energy, coming together with mindfulness? If it has those things, then you know that you're on the right track. But if it is a kind of peacefulness, but it doesn't really have much energy behind it, then it's not going to lead to samadhi, at least not straight away. You have to build up more energy, build up more piti, and then that mindfulness will give rise to samadhi eventually. Energy is one of the factors of the mind heading in the right direction. So, it is then, because of that, right, then the Buddha to be, he steadies his mind internally, quietens it down, brings it to singleness, and stills it, so that the mind should not be strained. So all of these words that you see there, these are words that refer to samadhi practice and jhanas quite specifically. So what the Buddha is doing here is kind of entering the states of jhana at this particular point. And this is one of the things which is interesting when you know the suttas quite broadly again, you know the life story of the Buddha, his awakening experience in many different places. It always involves samadhi. At one stage on the path, the Buddha enters these deep stages of samadhi. Not just in this sutta, but almost in all the suttas where he talks about the path of practice and how he achieved awakening. It is always goes via samadhi, via the jhanas. If you look at the Upakilesa Sutta, which is in many ways parallels this particular sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 128, it is Upakilesa, like defilement, is what it means. And in that sutta, very similar to this one, he talks about all these fine little refinements of the mind. And only after he's able to abandon those refinements, he actually then enters the jhana states. And then as a consequence of that, he attains awakening, right? This is a theme that you see throughout the suttas. One of the most interesting of these suttas is the sutta in Majjhima Nikaya 36, which is the Mahasatchaka Sutta, the greatest sutta discourse to Satchaka. And this is where the Buddha has a debate with this kind of famed Indian debater called Satchaka. And of course, the Buddha wins the debate, but in this debate, the Buddha talks about his path to awakening. And then there comes a point after he has practiced all the ascetic practices, and he sees that he's not getting the results. He doesn't actually find this final awakening that he's looking for. And so he sits down, take stock of the situation, and he says things to himself, I have now practiced these ascetic practices as far as it is possible. If I take these ascetic practices one step further, I will die, right? This is it. The way it is described there is very graphic, the way it is described in that particular sutta. Imagine my 36 if you're interested here. And it talks about how he's so thin that when he touches his stomach, he can feel the backbone, right? And that is really, really thin, if you think about it. So he basically taken everything to the absolute maximum. And then he thinks, well, in lay life, I took the kind of sensual pleasures, I took that to the maximum as well. I've taken these two extremes. And then he says, could there be another way to awakening? And that is when he has this recollection of when he was a child, he was sitting under the rose apple tree while his father was doing some kind of ceremony or something. And as a child, very kind of innocent, right, sitting there under the tree, he slipped into a jhana state at that point. So he remembers this, and he's thinking back, he thinks, could that be the path to awakening? And then he thinks, why am I afraid of that happiness that has got nothing to do with unwholesome states? And this is kind of the problem, and it's a recurring problem that you can see even in the Buddhist world today. People are kind of worried about profound happiness. They say, oh, you get attached to these things, they are problematic. But here the Buddha-to-be is saying, why am I afraid of that? Because it has got nothing to do with unwholesome qualities and unwholesome things. It is wrong to be afraid of these things. And then he says, could this be the path to awakening? And the insight dawned on me, this is the path to awakening. Right? Specifically in that sutta, Mahasatchaka Sutta. And of course, based on that then, this is where these things come in. He then practices those jhanas based on that recollection. There still may have been a time, maybe before, some time before he actually reached awakening itself, but there it is. So again, this, you know, when you read these things, you realize that these things, jhanas, deep samadhi, it is nothing to be afraid of. It is part of the path. You cannot drop things out of the path just because, you know, maybe if you do get attached to these things, well, you have to deal with that attachment. You cannot not do it because it is still part of the path. And then you deal with it once you get there. That is really what these things are saying. So these things are what you find throughout the suttas. This path is basically the same all the way throughout, and as it is here as well. Okay, so That is the first type of wholesome thought. That is, he then quietens down, and then we have the same thing with the other types of wholesome thought. As I abide thus, diligent, again heedful, energetic, and with effort, a thought of non-ill will arose in me, right? A thought of metta, of kindness towards others. A thought of non-cruelty, of compassion, if you like, arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of non-harming, of compassion, has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and it leads to Nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a day, even for a night, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from samadhi, from stillness. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and stilled it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. So there you are, same idea again. All these beautiful thoughts, right? Even all of these nice thoughts, you have to put them aside at a certain point. And when you do that, you then go into the deeper states of samadhi as a consequence. And then we have the simile again. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been brought inside the villages, a cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there. So too, there was need for me only to be mindful that those states or those qualities were present. So now the cowherd can relax a bit because there are no crops around. There are no bad thoughts anymore. The mind doesn't go astray anywhere. So all you have to do is to guard the cows. All you have to do is have mindfulness and, of course, clear comprehension just in case something bad happens. And then you can sit back, right? He just sits down at the root of a tree or out in the open. And this is a bit like sitting down in the meditation. And now the mind is kind of under control to some extent. And you sit back and you just enjoy the mind being mindful, the mind doing the right thing. This is what the whole point of things becoming easy. Once things have been the mind has been kind of sorted out and it has the habit of doing the right thing, then really all you have to do is be mindful. You don't have to kind of poke it here and there so much as you did before. And just aware that the good states of the mind are present. And then, bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thoughts of sensual desire to cultivate the thoughts of renunciation. And then his mind inclines to those thoughts of renunciation. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will, upon thoughts of non-harming, he has abandoned the thought of harming to cultivate the thought of non-harming. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of non-harming, to thoughts of compassion, to thoughts of kindness, and all of these kind of things. So this is the beautiful thing about this path. It becomes easier as you practice it, as you move in the right direction. And eventually, when you sit down to meditate and you relax and you find the ease in the mind, All of these things just flood your mind and you get this positive feeling. And when you get that positive feeling, then you stop thinking altogether. Put all those think thoughts aside, right? And just stay with the feeling itself. All that is left is the feeling. You don't need to encourage the feeling with thinking anymore. The feeling remains, and then as you watch the breath, as you do a meditation practice, the feeling becomes more and more powerful, more and more all-encompassing, spreading out into entire mind and body, and the body starts to disappear as well. And this is how eventually you enter into that stillness of samadhi completely in this way. There's a gradual descent into these things, and if you get it right, then you can see how beautiful it is when the mind actually is heading in this direction. So the very last line that I have included here, this is the very last line. So when the Buddha-to-be has all of these things are kind of sorted out, then tireless energy was aroused in me. Unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind stilled and unified. So when the defilements disappear, energy is aroused, right? The mind becomes energetic again. Tireless, you feel like this nuclear reactor again. Energy is just so powerful, so strong. It feels like you can never become tired until you come back out into the world and you get worn down again by all of these things. The worldly phenomena have a tendency to wear us down. Energy only lasts so long. But then again, you come back and you do some more of this, and the tireless energy is aroused again. And of course, this is the energy of the Dhamma, right? The energy that is required if you want to have insight and all of these kind of things. And with that comes the unremitting mindfulness. Mindfulness that is steady. The mindfulness that doesn't turn back. The mindfulness that is established. And there is no kind of moving in the wrong direction anymore. You are with the breath, and strongly so, and no going nowhere else. Body is tranquil and untroubled. The body sits there like a rock, not moving anywhere. You feel so content and happy. This is where contentment becomes much deeper, when the body becomes tranquil. A deep, deep sense of contentment. There's nothing you want to do in the entire world. You just want to sit there and be happy. And because the happiness is so profound and deep, because the contentment is so strong, because you don't want to do anything else, this becomes a magnet for your mind. Your mind is drawn towards this because it is so powerful and beautiful and wonderful. And that is how the mind becomes stilled, because you're not interested in anything else apart from the beauty and the happiness of that meditation happening right then and there. And that is how the mind then becomes stilled and unified as a consequence. And then, of course, after this, all the things that I have left out is the end of the path, the Buddha practicing this all the way to the end, going through the jhana stages, going through the three knowledges that we had a look at before, and all the way to the end of the path. But this is the hard work, right? This is the hard things that he have done here. Now he has laid the foundation, and everything else kind of happens very nicely as a consequence. So there you are. That is this sutta on the two kinds of thought. And as I said, you can see the gradual removal of defilements here. One defilement being removed and then gradually moving towards peace. And this other sutta, the soil remover sutta, way in, nicely remembered from me, the soil remover sutta from the Anguttara Nikaya has a very similar kind of structure, whereby you gradually remove the defilements of the mind, starting with a course of defilements, ending up with the most refined defilements. And one of the nice things in that soil remover sutta is that as you remove all the bad kind of thinking, the negative kind of thoughts, the very last kind of thinking mentioned in that sutta are thoughts about my reputation, thoughts about my family, thoughts about my country, right? Is actually mentioned in there. And these are quite interesting ideas, because these thoughts about your family, your country, your reputation, etc., these are the kind of thoughts that have very much to do with our sense of self, right? Who we are. We identify with these things. Our identity is connected with many of these things. And that gives you some idea of where some of these defilements are coming from, why it can be so hard to enter into deep states of samadhi, because of those attachment to our sense of identity. As the mind calms down, your sense of identity starts to be challenged, right? Because there's less and less things going on. You're not thinking about things anymore. You're not hearing anything. You have very little sense of who you are, apart from stillness and peace and bliss and all of these kind of things. And sometimes the mind doesn't like that. It wants to rebel a little bit, because that sense of identity is still deeply buried inside of us. And then the mind wants to think about that, and the mind is not happy with just being peaceful and still. So one of the aspects of calming the mind is also that we become more identity-less. Right? Less identity as you go into deeper and deeper stillness. You have to abandon the sense of who you are to a very large extent. It is the thinking mind that encourages this feeling of who we are, our sense of identity. You remove that, and this kind of stillness, emptiness arises instead. So what you have to do is you have to start to be aware of the beauty of the stillness and the emptiness inside of you. And as you do that, you are able gradually to let go of your sense of identity. And of course, in a deep state of samadhi, you don't have any identity anymore. You are completely beyond all that kind of stuff. No nationality, no gender, no religion, no social position, all of that has disappeared. What you are at that stage, you are just a mind, right? All of the other stuff has disappeared. And there's something very beautiful about that, because it is a kind of universal experience, and you realize at that point, in a sense, you can see at this point comes the unity between all beings and everyone else. At that point, we are all the same, and there's no distinction anymore. That is a very useful thing to think of, and this is one of the reasons why these states are so powerful and why they are so intoxicating, because you quite literally feel at unified with the universe, right? You think, wow, this is so beautiful. There's no distinction between me and everyone else anymore. You are part and parcel of everything, and there's a sense of a feeling that everybody can live together as brothers and sisters in the entire world, also because you have no defilements anymore. Identities, differences have disappeared. There's no comparison anymore. And what a powerful thing that is. And this is why it is so intoxicating, and many people get carried away by these kind of states. But part and parcel of this is to actually abandon already in this life some of our sense of identity. Not to be too proud and too concerned about nationality and gender and social position and wealth and all of these other things, because in the end, these other things you're going to have to abandon and leave behind on this path into samadhi. And you feel how not having an identity is so superior to having an identity. It is so much more blissful, so much more happy. Takes away the boundaries, and that is a very beautiful and powerful thing in its own right. Okay, so that is enough for now, and so let's have a short break, and we'll see you back again at 3:15.